That day, it was a great thing among the boys to have hair of so flexible a sort that it could be flung back in that way with a flirt of the head. George Robards was the envy of us all, for there was no hair among us that was so competent for this exhibition as his, except perhaps the yellow locks of Will Bowen and John Robards. My hair was a dense ruck of short curls, and so was my brother Henry's. We tried all kinds of devices to get these crooks straightened out so that they would flirt, but we never succeeded. Sometimes by soaking our heads and then combing and brushing our hair down tight and flat to our skulls, we could get it straight temporarily. This gave us a comforting moment of joy, but the first time we gave it a flirt, it all shriveled into curls again and our happiness was gone. John Robards was the little brother of George. He was a wee chap with silky golden curtains to his face, which dangled to his shoulders and below, and could be flung back ravishingly. When he was 12 years old, he crossed the plains with his father amidst the rush of the gold seekers of 49. Remember the departure of the cavalcade when it spurred westward. We were all there to see and to envy, and I can still see that proud little chap sailing by on a great horse with his long locks streaming out behind. We were all on hand to gaze and envy when he returned 2 years later, in unimaginable glory, for he had traveled. None of us had ever been 40 miles from home, but he had crossed the continent. He had been in the gold mines, that fairyland of our imagination, and he had done a still more wonderful thing. In ships on the actual ocean, in ships on 3 actual oceans. For he had sailed down the Pacific and around the Horn among icebergs and through snowstorms and wild wintry gales, and had sailed on and turned the corner and flown northward in the trades, and up through the blistering equatorial waters, and there, in his brown face, were the proofs of what he had been through. We would have sold our souls to Satan for the privilege of trading places with him. I saw him when I was out on that Missouri trip 4 years ago. He was old then, though not quite so old as I, and the burden of life was upon him. He said his granddaughter, 12 years old, had read my books and would like to see me. It was a pathetic time, for she was a prisoner in her room and marked for death, and John knew that she was passing swiftly away. 12 years old, just her grandfather's age when he rode away on that great journey with his yellow hair flapping behind him. In her, I seemed to see that boy again. It was as if he had come back out of that remote past and was present before me in his golden youth. Her malady was heart disease, and her brief life came to a close a few days later. Another of those schoolboys
Pretending that
were all good boys and good girls and drearily uninteresting, but they were better society than none, and I was glad to have their company and disapprove of it. 20 years ago, Mr. Richmond had become possessed of Tom Sawyer's cave in the hills 3 miles from town and had made a tourist resort of it. In 1849, when the gold seekers were streaming through our little town of Hannibal, many of our grown men got the gold fever, and I think that all the boys had it. On the Saturday holidays in summertime, we used to borrow skiffs whose owners were not present and go down the river 3 miles to the cave hollow, Brazilian for valley. And there we staked out claims and pretended to dig gold, handing out half a dollar a day at first, 2 or 3 times as much later, and by and by whole fortunes as our imaginations became inured to the work. Stupid and unprophetic lads, we were doing this in play and never suspecting. Why, that cave hollow and all the adjacent hills were made of gold, but we did not know it. We took it for dirt. We left its rich secret in its own peaceful possession and grew up in poverty and went wandering about the world struggling for bread, and this because we had not the gift of prophecy. That region was all dirt and rocks to us, yet all it needed was to be ground up and scientifically handled, and it was gold. That is to say, the whole region was a cement mine, and they make the finest kind of Portland cement there now, 5,000 barrels a day, with a plant that costs $2 million. For a little while, Ruel Gridley attended that school of ours. He was an elderly pupil. He was perhaps 22 or 23 years old. Then came the Mexican War, and he volunteered. A company of infantry was raised in our town, and Mr. Hickman, a tall, straight, handsome athlete of 25, was made captain of it. He had a sword by his side and a broad yellow stripe down the leg of his gray pants. And when that company marched back and forth through the streets in its smart uniform, which it did several times a day for drill, its evolutions were attended by all the boys whenever the school hours permitted. I can see that marching company yet, and I can almost feel again the consuming desire that I had to join it. But they had no use for boys at 12 and 13, and before I had a chance in another war, the desire to kill people to whom I had not been introduced had passed away. I saw the splendid Hickman in his old age. He seemed about the oldest man were other boys whose names remain with me. Irving Ayers, but no matter, he is dead. Then there was George Butler, whom I remember as a child of 7 wearing a blue leather belt with a brass buckle, and hated and envied by all the boys on account of it. He was a nephew of General Ben Butler and fought gallantly at Ball's Bluff and several other actions of the Civil War. He is dead long and long ago. We were halted in a fine old hall whence we could see, through a corridor of some length, the massed audience in the theater. Here for a little time we moved about and chatted and made acquaintanceships. Then the DCLs were summoned and they marched through that corridor and the shouting began in the theater. It would be some time before the doctors of literature and of science would be called for, because each of those DCLs had to have a couple of Latin speeches made over him before his promotion would be complete. One by the Regius, professor of civil law, the other by the chancellor. After a while, I asked Sir William Ramsay if a person might smoke here and not get shot. And he said, yes, but that whoever did it and got caught would be fined a guinea and perhaps hanged later. He said he knew of a place where we could accomplish at least as much as half of the smoke before any informers would be likely to chance upon us, and he was ready to show the way to any who might be willing to risk the guinea and the hanging. By request, he led the way, and Kipling, Sir Norman Lockyer, and I followed. We crossed an unpopulated quadrangle and stood under one of its exits, an archway of massive masonry, and there we lit up and began to take comfort. The photographers had arrived, but they were courteous and friendly and gave us no trouble, and we gave them none. They grouped us in all sorts of ways and photographed us at their village and pleasure while we smoked and talked. We were there more than an hour. Then we returned to headquarters, happy, content, and greatly refreshed. Presently, we filed into the theater under a very satisfactory hurrah and waited in the crimson column, dividing the crowded pit through the middle until each of us in his turn should be called to stand before ooze and drip and stream through house doors all over the old town, blend towards the meadows outside the walls. Soon the lanes were thronged with costumes which Oxford had from time to time seen and been familiar with in bygone centuries. Fashions of dress which marked off centuries as by dates and milestoned them back and back and back until history faded into legend and tradition. Arthur was a fact, and the Round Table a reality. In this rich commingling of quaint and strange and brilliantly colored fashions in dress, the dress changes of Oxford for 12 centuries stood livid and realized to the eye. Oxford, as a dream of the Middle Ages, was complete now, as it had never in our day before been complete. At last there was no discord. The smoldering old buildings and the picturesque throngs drifting past them were in harmony. Soon, astonishingly soon, the only persons that seemed out of place and grotesquely and offensively and criminally out of place were such persons as came intruding along, clothed in the ugly and odious fashions of the 20th century. They were a bitterness to the feelings, an insult to the eye. The makeups of the lustrous historic personages seemed perfect, both as to portraiture and costume. One had no trouble in recognizing them. Also, I was apparently quite easily recognizable myself. The first corner I turned brought me suddenly face to face with Henry VIII, a person whom I had been implacably disliking for 60 years. But when he put out his hand with royal courtliness and grace and said, "Welcome, well-beloved stranger, to my century and to the hospitalities of my realm," my old prejudices vanished away and I forgave him. I think now that Henry VIII has been overabused, and that most of us, if we had been situated as he was domestically, would not have been able to get along with as limited a graveyard as he forced himself to put up with. I feel now that he was one of the nicest men in history. Personal contact with the king is more effective in removing baleful prejudices than is any amount of argument drawn from tales and histories. If I had a child, I would name it Henry VIII, regardless statuary history. These were most thrilling and charming encounters. I had handshakes with Henry II, who had not been seen in the Oxford streets for nearly 800 years, and with the fair Rosamond, whom I now believed had been chaste and blameless, although I had thought differently about it before. And with Shakespeare, one of the pleasantest foreigners I have ever gotten acquainted with, and with Roger Bacon, and with Queen Elizabeth, who talked 5 minutes and never swore once, a fact which gave me a new and good opinion of her, and moved me to forgive her for beheading the Scottish Mary, if she really did it, which I now doubt. And with the quaintly and anciently clad young King Carl Carefoot of near 900 years ago, who came flying by on a bicycle and smoking a pipe, but at once checked up and got off to shake with me. And also I met a bishop who had lost his way because this was the first time he had been inside the walls of Oxford for as much as 1,200 years or thereabouts. By this time I had grown so used to the obliterated ages and their best-known people that if I had met Adam, I should not have been either surprised